I'm Matthew Petty and this is Intersection. Three churches in Melbourne have been vandalised, one repeatedly in the last few months. The Shiloh Christian Centre, New Shiloh Christian Centre and the Central Baptist Church have been hit by vandals from February through the summer. Church property was tagged with hateful graffiti and Nazi symbols. Fires were lit and the vandals stole a small bronze statue of an eagle. Now the FBI is investigating, they're asking the public for help to solve the case, and they're offering up a $5,000 reward. The New Shiloh Christian Centre is predominantly black, and the FBI is treating the case as a hate crime. They believe the vandalism was carried out by the same small group. What's behind this vandalism spree in Melbourne, and what effect is it having on the community? What about the hate crime label? Is it appropriate? We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can join the conversation. That's 1-866-338-5252. And with me in the studio, Daryl Owens from the Orlando Sentinel. Welcome back to Intersection, Daryl.
Thank you, Matthew. Good morning to you.
And we also have Mark Bernier, host of the Mark Bernier Show. He's with WNDB in Daytona Beach, and he joins us from Daytona Beach. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you, Matthew.
And also in the studio, Matt Reed, Florida Today, host of the Matt Reed Show. Nice to have you back, Matt.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about this vandalism spree striking multiple churches in the Melbourne area since February. The FBI is investigating. They've put up a reward. Is $5,000 enough, though, to flush out the culprits? 1-866-338-5252. That's the number if you want to join the conversation. 1-866-338-5252. Taking your calls. Matt Reed, this began way back in February. The FBI says it believes the vandalism has been carried out by the same small group, but so far no suspects. What's Melbourne's history with these types of crime? Is this something brand new?
No, it's not brand new. This has gone on. I've been in the Brevard County area since 2001, and off and on we've had this kind of vandalism. This is a little bit more sustained and focused. I think that the fact that the FBI has been called in on this signifies that law enforcement takes it very seriously and is struggling to find the people who have done this. Mm-hmm. If it were a bunch of dumb kids that were just doing, you know, skateboarding by and tagging the place, or they would have found them by now. These, you know, people like that typically blab to their friends and they get caught in social media. That hasn't happened. And here's the FBI offering a reward, which means even they aren't coming up with great leads in mm-hmm. the case. I'm as puzzled as they are. However, it does concern you. I mean, we had a controversy in Melbourne, for example, over the Confederate flag in a parade.
Sure.
And I heard things come out in public debates that sounded like something from my grandparents' era, frankly. Mm-hmm. I had lunch with a local attorney and lobbyist who was African-American, and we were talking about leadership and the fact that we have so many black men now in really top leadership positions in a very white conservative county, mm-hmm. people who were hired and elected by conservative people, how great that was. And yet he was saying, look, don't go there. Don't make an issue out of that, please, because we are really concerned about the element in this county that can be hostile mm-hmm. to that.
Is there a race relations problem in Melbourne?
You don't see it day to day. I mean, mm-hmm. people aren't fist fighting and calling each other names on the streets or at Starbucks or anything like that. I mean, but obviously we do have a problem. If churches are being attacked and people are being intimidated, I don't know anything more about the crime. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm as stumped, like I said, as the other law enforcement people. But I'm glad to see that they're taking it seriously enough to call in the FBI and offer a reward.
So, Matt Reed, what's the community saying? You know, where's the outrage here?
Well, I think, you know, it depends on where you go. I mean, mm-hmm. if you go to a, you know, when I talk with people at churches, or I go and I talk to African-American people in Brevard County, they are outraged. They feel put upon and concerned and, mm-hmm. and intimidated by something like this. They talk about it quite a bit. You don't hear it on our local talk radio. You don't see it necessarily coming in letters to the editor. I think that there is a lot of just with the church vandalism in particular, we've made it news. It's making headlines, but mostly it's a curiosity at this point for a lot of the readers.
Mm-hmm. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. Call in and join the conversation. We're talking about that spree of vandalism directed against some largely black churches in the Melbourne area since February. The FBI stumped by this. Daryl Owens, I want to talk to you. Daryl Owens from the Orlando Sentinel. So much of the national dialogue in the last year has been about race, conversations sparked by incidents like the death of Michael Brown in St. Louis, the shooting of Walter Scott, many more. How does this incident, the church has been vandalized in Melbourne, how does that fit into that national conversation?
Well, I think it's symptomatic of the worsening racial animus and the widening racial divide that has metastasized across this country. Poll after poll show that Americans hold a dim view on race relations in America. And I think the rising racial tension that we've been seeing in recent months and the increasing audacity of Americans to reveal their racial animus is on display here and across the country.
Mm-hmm. What about the local response to this, Daryl Owens? Would you expect to see more community outrage over these acts of vandalism?
Well, you know, I think that the community response mirrors the national response because, let's face it, black churches have been vandalized or burned since the 60s, and the symbolism is powerful. It's an attack on an institution that is central to the African-American community, both as a sheltering standpoint, but also as a rallying point for political activism. So in 1996, Congress passed a law enhancing the sentences for arsonists who attack religious groups because of race or ethnicity, yet the burnings and vandalism still continues.
And yet you say, you know, the 1960s, of course, it seems an anachronism to be seeing this kind of thing happen now in 2015.
Yeah, it definitely seemed like we pressed the repeat button.
Mark Bernier, host of the Mark Bernier Show with WNDB, I want to bring you into the conversation. Earlier this year, hackles were up over the Daytona 500's decision to ask fans to keep their Confederate flags away from the speedway. I just want to wonder what your thoughts are on this. What does it say that NASCAR is chiming in on this kind of race relations issue?
Yeah, I think it's kind of unnecessary, but I understand. NASCAR is trying to show everybody, hey, look, you know, we're with the national trend. We don't want this. We're going to encourage our fans not to bring this in. There's been no trouble, to my knowledge, in any NASCAR event, Matthew. But, you know, and again, I don't fault them, but I don't think it was necessary. The problem is a lot of NASCAR fans, remember, a lot of racing is in the South.
Yep.
A lot of these people consider it part of their heritage, and they want to bring flags. You're going to see some people show up anyway, and it could be a little uncomfortable if people tell them to put them away. I'm not hearing a huge amount of African-American people protesting at NASCAR races over people who come in with flags and those emblems on their bags and hats and I mean, it's just part of the American scene, but I realize they want to be in step with the rest of the country. The problem is, when you do this, it opens the door for everybody else to suddenly get creative about being offended by something. So it's not going to stop with the Confederate flag. There's going to be something else next year and the year after that. That's my worry.
Mark, I'm wondering, too, I mean, you speak to a more conservative crowd, perhaps, than we do here at Public Radio. What are your listeners, WNDB, saying about the Black Lives Matter and maybe the Confederate flag issues?
Okay, less to the Confederate flag, but they are speaking to it. They think it's nonsense. They don't think that NASCAR had to, but they accept it. I do get callers who do think that, yes, it's about time we make that thing go away because it symbolizes slavery. There's always a debate about whether it's states' rights or slavery, but, you know, slavery was part of the issue that drove it. More about Black Lives Matter. I think people are outraged. All lives matter. And what about babies' lives? I mean, not to bring the presidential race into it, but Ben Carson identified that when he was asked the question. You know, what about babies and what about white lives? I mean, there's a group organizing Cops' Lives Matter. I mean, all lives matter. To suggest that there is a systemic problem in this country where police target African-Americans to execute them is ridiculous. I mean, there's nothing that bases the basis on that. Most police officers are good, hardworking people that want to protect everyone.
And I'm sure a lot of the Black Lives Matter folks would agree with that last sentiment there, Mark Bernier. But they would also say there is evidence for, you know, what they say is the systematic targeting of folks in the black community. I just want to move back to Daryl Owens, though. Daryl, here's a question for you about the back to the church vandalism issue. You know, what's the effect of calling something a hate crime? What does that do to it?
Well, though hate crimes can be difficult to prove because motivation is a central element, the enhanced penalties for crimes committed solely because of the perpetrator's racial or religious bias against a victim do acknowledge the fact that hate crimes differ from other crimes in their impact on victims and on the stability of the community.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to another story. We'll stay in Volusia County, though, for this next story. The chair of the Volusia County Commission, Jason Davis, is suggesting a pay raise of 67% for himself if he's re-elected in 2016. Now, that would see his salary jump from $51,000 to $85,000. Davis says it's not the first time the idea has been raised. He's not the only one talking about it either. Davis left his job at an AM radio station. He told the Daytona Beach News Journal that it's hitting him hard in the wallet. Now, with the cost of gas, he says it's almost like working for free, the amount of traveling he does.
Please.
Does the salary of the county commission chair fit the job? Does he deserve a pay raise? What about the other commissioners on the Volusia County Commission? We want to hear your thoughts. 1-866-338-5252. Join the conversation. That's 1-866-338-5252, talking about the salaries for elected officials, whether it's in Volusia County or other county commissions. Mark Bernier, this is right in your backyard. Tell us about Jason Davis. Is this his only job, and who is he?
Well, this is like being in the desert with a canteen, and I can't wait to open it. All right, several issues here. First, this is a suggestion that goes to the charter. We're having charter review. This is mm-hmm. a charter-driven county. They're having charter review. He made this suggestion to the chairman, Hyatt Brown, and Jason is suggesting raising the salary, which I understand, but this is never going to see the light of day. If the Charter Commission decides to put it before the voters would decide on it next year, and I think they're going to say no. There's a whole bunch of tax increases coming down the line, and there are increases coming in taxing districts. So when you collectively look at that, plus the county is talking about trying to raise the sales tax to cover transportation costs, mm-hmm. it's too much. They'll never raise it that much. Mm-hmm. Jason Davis was in the military. He went into the private sector. He was a dark horse candidate when he ran. He wasn't expected to win. As a matter of fact, he wasn't even expected to get out of the primary. He only spent $10,000 to run for this, a more empowered position. He won against all odds. He was backed largely by Tea Party people and the Republican Party, though it's non-party. That's supposed to be nonpartisan, this race.
Mm-hmm.
He worked part-time for a radio station in New Smyrna Beach, but I find this incredulous to think that he's going to make it up because he gave up that job. I mean, he told us that he was largely a board operator for the Boston Pops on the weekend. I even spoke to the owner of the radio station. I'm saying, man, were you paying him that much? Mm-hmm. And he kind of laughed. He got into this knowing that he was going to dedicate his life full time to this. It is a big job.
Yep.
But with he does. He's
and you've got to cover a lot of ground too, right? I mean, you got to travel some distance
county,
to get out there.
But still, it doesn't deserve this. And not only are they going to raise his salary, that the county council people, their salaries are going to come up.
Mm-hmm.
But he wants more than that. You know, he wants to get transportation costs covered. You know, right now they don't pay you anything if you're in the county,
right?
If they're outside the county, but there, and I know you have other things in this that he's asking for, but mm-hmm. It's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. I doubt it.
Darrell Owens, let me ask you this question. You know, the same argument's been made for state lawmakers. Pay them a professional salary and they do a better job of making laws. How long has that idea been floating around for?
Matthew, probably as long as lawmakers have been running for office, be my assumption there. But most lawmakers would at least publicly say that the joy of serving outstrips the personal sacrifice involved in being a public servant.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough job, as has been said, and economic hard times demand that lawyers work harder hours. They are putting more money out of their own pocket to do the job.
You said lawyers, you mean lawmakers?
Lawmakers, I'm sorry, mm-hmm. I did misspeak, thank you. And like many of their constituents, their salaries are not keeping up with the cost of their workload. So, you know, that's their argument, and it's a hard one to disagree with in a lot of respects.
And as far as what the public says about this, I mean, commissioners in Orlando wanted to give themselves a pay raise of 21% back in 2013, but eventually they backed off of that idea, voting for something a little bit smaller. Was that a popular move with the voters?
Hardly. After a tsunami of a withering public criticism, Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer and the city council retreated from the 21% raise, settling for a 6% pay hike. Mm-hmm. And though Dyer argued that market comparisons to commissioners in other counties justified the 21% mm-hmm. pay hike, he concluded that it sent the wrong message.
Matt Reed, not every commissioner is feeling too hard done by. In your neck of the woods in Brevard County, Jim Barfield donated his salary to charity, and that's a take-home pay of $40,000 a year, not to be sniffed at. Barfield says he doesn't need the money. But what about other commissioners in Brevard County? Do some of them would some of them like a pay raise?
Probably so. Listen, Jim Barfield is a good guy. He ran for office because he's civically minded. He grew up in the area. He is the CEO of a global company that staffs hospitals around the world at government facilities, military bases, that kind of a thing. And he could, to me, I was surprised that somebody like that might take step aside a little bit and run for public office. The thing that's frustrating to me is when you see the type of people who can run for office because of the pay. Now, mm-hmm. it's not poverty wage. I mean, our county commissioners make about $60,000 a year or something about that. Our school board has an interesting idea. Our school board members get paid the average teacher wage. Mm-hmm. I think it would be interesting if more places did something like that where, you know, they'd be in tune with what their people are actually making. It's something they could potentially live on, and it's not – you know what I'm saying? It's not exorbitant mm-hmm. either.
Mm-hmm. But a lot of teachers have to do something else in the summer months to kind of make up, you know, especially if they have a family, a couple of kids, you know, mortgages to pay, that kind of thing.
Hey, listen, I'm married to one, and she's constantly teaching online classes and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you look at the type of people who can run for office. It's either people who are independently wealthy. It's retirees. It's people who just have gigantic egos and two or three, you know, kind of part-time jobs, and they're a little weird. The entire management class of this state, who are very smart, problem-solving, rational family people, are not the people who you see running for office, frankly, because they don't want to give up a great job mm-hmm. to do something that's a part-time public service job.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. When we come back, we're going to talk about Port Canaveral CEO John Walsh and his decision to step down. Why is he making that decision to resign come January? And where does it leave the port? You can weigh in with your thoughts if you have some ideas about Port Canaveral and what's going on there. 1-866-338-5252. That's the number, 1-866-338-5252. Intersection returns in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Hospital, honoring firefighters throughout Central Florida who risk their lives every day to save the lives of those who otherwise would have perished. Florida Hospital, thanking firefighters who do not just stamp out flames, they change lives. Florida Hospital, life is amazing.
Good morning. We made it to Friday. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're taking your calls live. Join the conversation. You can take us with you anywhere you go throughout the day by downloading the WMFE mobile app. It's free for Apple and Android devices.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Visit Central Florida, presenting An American in Venice, James McNeil Whistler and His Legacy, October 10th through December 5th at the Polk Museum of Art, featuring 11 prints by Whistler juxtaposed with works from his followers. More info at artscentral.org.
Welcome back to Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Matt Reed from Florida Today, Daryl Owens, Orlando Sentinel, and from Daytona Beach, Mark Bernier, WNDB, and host of The Mark Bernier Show. You can join the conversation. We're at 1-866-338-5252. On to a story about Port Canaveral. The CEO, John Walsh, has agreed to resign. The announcement came not long after he apologized for calling opponents of a proposed rail line to the port, quote, Luddites. He apologized, but his comments angered plenty of residents in Brevard County. That proposed rail line would have gone over the Indian River Lagoon. Environmental advocates weren't too happy with the idea, which Walsh said is key to growing the port, the rail line that is, and growing the port's business. What are the pluses and minuses of this proposed rail line? Is there a way to balance out the environmental needs with the economic benefits that would come from a rail line to the port? 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Join the conversation. Matt Reed, it sounds like John Walsh misread the situation pretty dramatically here. Just what happened?
Well, the port has been going through a massive expansion for the past few years. It had a lot of cash, and it was sitting on, and it wasn't growing. And John Walsh has presided over a couple of years of very serious investment and construction of new cruise terminals, a cargo operation that's new out there. We have a redevelopment of the entertainment and dining area called The Cove. There's a self-funded deepening and widening of the channel out there to handle new big boats. That is all big work. And John Walsh is a construction guy and developer. He has been good at that part. Mm-hmm. Not a great politician. John is a I've gotten to know him over the years, but covering some of the issues, he was kind of a stubborn guy with a volcanic temper. And some of the issues, like this proposed bridge over the Indian River or Banana River to get cargo containers off, became very political. You've got county commissioners that were against it, trying to represent constituents and environmentalists and sport fishing people. The Air Force is involved. Hoteliers in Cocoa Beach are hyper-politically involved and want to see the port go in this direction or that. And I think it's really a job that's probably perfect for a university president, you know, who is just constantly dealing with crossfire of politics. And I think that he just dug in and lost the support of his board, who decided that they needed somebody with a better ear for politics.
Mm-hmm. In a statement, Walsh said he leaves the port better than when he arrived a few years ago. Is this true, or does his resignation really leave the port in a bind?
Well, I think the port is in a much more competitive, modern position than it was before. The cruise industry out there has exploded. They've got the biggest ships. If we're not the biggest, busiest cruise port in the world now, we're the second busiest right behind Miami. But you can't have all your eggs in one basket. That's just dumb economically. And the expansion into cargo and the hiring of a global contractor that makes the sales and is going to get those logistics coming in is fantastic for Brevard County. Getting how we do that, how we get the cargo containers off that beachside barrier island port to the mainland rail lines is a big question. You get one chance to do that right. Mm-hmm. It has to fit with our community. It has to fit with people's sensibilities and be good for the environment. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to a lot of people that John Walsh had decided on an unpopular route and was going to, like a fullback, just charge that thing into the end zone when there were other routes. There were other options that a more sensitive, responsive person might have seen. You know, this one's going to be harder and more expensive, but that's what the community wants. So let's try to push a little harder and see if that's going to work.
Darrell Owens, your newspaper ran a column, not too long ago. John Walsh, rather, made it into the chump/champ section of the paper in the chump column for his comment about Luddites. I wonder, though, from somebody who's not living in the on the coast, was this a surprising Walsh kind of tumble pretty precipitously from that spot as the CEO of Port Canaveral?
Well, based on the way that Matt described him and his volcanic temper, I would have to say no. But, any time that someone who is in such a high position does tumble, I guess it does present a bit of a shock.
Mm-hmm. Mark Bernier, rail lines, whether they're freight or passenger lines, always seem to come with some concerns and caveats. Sunrail, for example, stretches into Volusia County, that commuter train. But there have been questions about just how far it should go in the future and who's going to be left holding the bag once the state stops funding the rail line. What would a commuter train linking DeLand to Orlando, for example, what impact would that have on Volusia County? Would DeLand become more of a bedroom community for Orlando?
That's a good question. Probably not. I think DeLand is further away than Deltona, which really is a bedroom community for Orlando. It would benefit Orlando a lot because it would people who want to go shopping and experience athletics and all the things that go on in the downtown of Orlando would have easy access. It would certainly take some cars off I-4. The real problem, Matthew, is going to be the cost of trying to bring it to DeLand. Nobody has been able to work that out. And, of course, Josh Wagner wants to see it come all the way to Daytona Beach. We'd love to see that come maybe to the speedway or the airport. But again, there are a lot of hurdles they have to go through. They have to find the funding for it. There could be some eminent domain issues. It's a way off. And we have this looming bill that has to be paid. It only comes into DeBerry now. Mm-hmm. And they haven't figured out how they're going to pay for that down the road. So all those questions have to be answered before we'll ever see it get to the land.
1-866-338-5252. We're talking about rail, the possibility of some cargo rail through to Port Canaveral, and also commuter rail stretching into Volusia County. 1-866-338-5252. We'd love to hear from you. There's been talk, Mark Bernier, forever about linking Daytona Beach to Orlando by train. It used to be tourists would spend the week on the beach and then maybe a day at the theme parks, but that seems to have flipped on its head. Is it time for Daytona to realize that it's in its best interest to hook its wagon, so to speak, to Disney?
They do, and they have for some time wanted to do that, and they would pitch Daytona as, hey, we have the beach, this is our big deal, and of course when racing is here, a lot of people come, and then they want to get away for a day. They'll go to Disney. So they're doing it now, but they want to be very careful because a lot of folks will end up staying at Disney because Disney has covered everything for the experience of the visitor. They don't need to leave to go to a hotel someplace. Mm-hmm. So there was some marketing. Daytona was actually marketing on cabs and other vehicles inside Orlando to get people to spend a day over here, and they'll still do it. Now, when the Hard Rock happens, which we all believe it's going to happen, and some of the uplifted hotels on Beachside, it's going to be a little more attractive. Mm-hmm. There's this whole issue of whether cars will remain on the beach. I think that's going to come into play.
Yeah, what are your listeners saying about the cars on the beach?
Well, we just went through a decision by a judge who turned down the request by those people who signed the petition to get it before the voters next year. It was a week ago that happened. Mm-hmm. So the county council voted to create a mechanism where if these two hotels follow all of the criteria, then and only then would they remove cars from the front of that part of the beach. But those hotels have to go through all of that. It's not going to happen tomorrow, but it is coming, and the county is preparing itself to buy more land because eventually, the cars are all going to come off the beach.
Mm-hmm. That's something that folks in Daytona Beach aren't too happy with. I mean, you mentioned that petition. There are people who say it's basically kind of birthright to be able to drive on the beach, at least for a couple miles.
Yeah, but I can tell you this. I think it's a myth to think that everybody here wants the cars on the beach. There are a lot of people who still feel that that's their birthright. But the practicality of trying to continue to drive cars on a beach that's getting more narrow with the sand changing is crazy. I think the county's trying to get ahead of it because there will be eventually a point where you can't drive on certain parts of the beach. It's becoming – there's less now to drive on than there was. The beach is, in fact, narrower. Mm-hmm. So I do think that the new people coming here are seeing that, yeah, okay, it's nice, and there'll probably be always a little stretch where there's driving, but by and large, you're not going to see it the way it was in the 50s.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's stay with the theme of economics and talk about Florida Governor Rick Scott, and he made a visit not too long ago to Kentucky to herald a job swoop, basically grabbing an aerospace company and bringing back 40 jobs to Florida. Well, let's hear a little bit from the ad that Enterprise Florida was playing in Kentucky right before Governor Scott made his visit.
And now an important message from the state of Florida. Are Frankfurt's pro-union and big government policies hurting your business? Good news is on the way. Florida Governor Rick Scott is coming to Kentucky to share Florida's success story. As a right-to-work state with no income tax, Florida is ranked number 2 by CEOs for its business environment. Take your business to the next level.
An ad there playing on Kentucky radio right before Governor Scott went to herald the bringing that company back to Florida. The local media, though, not too impressed by the visit. Sam Youngman wrote a column in the Lexington Herald Leader titled, Florida Governor Makes Long Trip to Lexington for 40 Jobs and a Crass Political Stunt. Daryl Owens, what's the political payoff for a visit like this?
Well, for Scott, it scores him brownie points within the party. It positions him as a person who is in line with the union-busting trend that the GOP has adopted, and it also helps to elevate his profile within the community at large, particularly if he truly is considering a Senate run, as many expect, or even higher office.
Mm-hmm. Rick Scott branded himself the jobs governor, but are 40 jobs worth going all the way to Kentucky for?
Well, you can look at that from two vantage points. From a sheer numbers perspective, 40 jobs isn't a breathtaking success and perhaps not worth the time and investment, though I confess I'm not sure about whether any incentives may have been involved in wooing this particular company. But if you look at it from a different perspective, if these are 40 high-paying jobs, high-paying tech jobs, and they have the potential to impact more than 40 families with an economic cascade effect. And it can also provide a carrot to attract similar businesses who begin to see Florida as a growing tech hub.
Mm-hmm. Mark Bernier, let me come to you on this question. Are 40 jobs worth going all the way to Kentucky for?
There's a bad moon rising every time you do this. I don't like this. I like the governor. I support his desire to create jobs, but I do not like this. And they put press releases out. And heck, if a Dairy Queen is coming here, I mean, enough already.
Mm-hmm.
40 jobs is not enough. And here's the big problem, Matthew. I don't like our governor and state going into another state to poach jobs from another state. I don't want it done to us. And it's going to start happening. We have an office set up on Long Island. Did you know this?
No.
That taxpayers pay for it. The office of the governor of the state of Florida, and its main purpose is to get people who have companies on Long Island to come to Florida. I call it poaching. I'm not comfortable with it. Maybe that's the way the world is going, but I don't want it done to us. What if Texas decides to set up shop here or Pennsylvania and say, you know, come to Pennsylvania?
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't like that.
Yeah, and actually just on the issue of Texas, Governor Scott has kind of called out Texas saying that he wants to kind of take over Texas, so to speak, as the most jobs-friendly state. Mark Bernier, though, let me just come back to something with an economic impact here. You know, back to the idea of beach driving. I know we've talked a lot about this in past shows, but, you know, there is an economic argument to be made for getting those cars off the beach. That's what a lot of the commissioners are saying. They're saying they don't want those cars in front of those new luxury hotels. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, what's the kind of tenor of the community, the folks who listen to your show? What are they saying about that?
Well, they think it's a sellout. They think that a lot of people who call, and you have to remember that people who call a call-in talk show about an issue as emotional as this have an axe to grind. I think most right-thinking people who are weighing the greater impact of the community realize it helps grow the tax base. As I tried to explain to folks, you know, fun is fun, but in the end, if we don't find ways to grow our tax base, then the burden of paying for services falls totally on the homeowners. Let's expand. Let's get more people paying taxes. Let's not raise taxes. That argument falls upon deaf ears from the people who romanticize mm-hmm. about what it's like to drive a car in the sand. And the practicality is it's necessary to grow the economy there,
mm-hmm.
To take cars off the beach so that we can have a higher tax-paying clientele that's there to drive the economy.
So I want to go to a phone call now. We've got Walt. Walt is calling from Daytona Beach. Walt, you're on the air. What about this argument of getting cars off so we can kind of bump up the economy in Daytona Beach?
Well, the Daytona Beach economy, first of all, is exploding. This is a bedroom community that has woken up. There's building and construction everywhere in Daytona Beach right now. It's robust. And we still have cars on the beach. So that's mm-hmm. point one. We're doing quite well. The economy's strong. Now, the second item is that in the United States, we have over 5,000 miles of beach. I think we can take 10 miles of the 5,000 and use that for beach driving because it makes Daytona Beach totally unique.
Mm-hmm.
We are one of a kind, something special. And not, just like Key West is special, there's nothing else like it. Driving on the beach is unique to Daytona. And
Walt,
then the third item,
Walt, can I ask you before you move on, did you grow up in Daytona Beach? Have you been there for a good while?
I've been here for a good while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wasn't born here. Like a lot of people, I was very blessed to get to live here. But I've been here for quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
And the third item, which is the specious argument that the county's too big, you can't do that anymore, it doesn't work, that's baloney. Because here's why. If you've ever been in any hotel in the United States and it has a meeting room, that meeting room has an occupancy max for safety, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our beaches are all, you have to go through a booth to get into the beach, the access to drive through. You can have a number, you can say a maximum occupancy is, we're going to sell, as an example, 500 accesses a day. And when you hit that number, you hit that number and you shut it down. Just mm-hmm. like a meeting room that happens every single day in every hotel.
You're breaking up, Walt, but I do appreciate your call. Thank you so much for calling in. Let me just go back to you, Mark Bernier, for a minute. Idea that the beach driving is something that makes the beach unique, makes Daytona unique, kind of part of the heritage. I mean, do you talk to people who are visiting for the first time maybe and saying, look, this is the reason I came?
Absolutely, I do. I live on the beach, and I talk to people. You know, I don't get anything out of this because, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, when I had young children, I took them to beaches that didn't have cars, so I wouldn't have to deal with that. But it's, again, this fallacy that it makes the economy. It doesn't. Show me one living testimony that says, you know, by having cars on the beach, we were able to build this, so we got this. Mm-hmm. It's not. Most people, Evelyn Fine's Mid-Florida Marketing, asked people who come here if it was driving on the beach, and the majority said no. So, you know, it's people who have lived here for a while. I've been here 25 years. And, you know, most of the people that I meet that are visitors, and I ask them all, and I try to sell them on the idea. I even say to them, you know, wouldn't it be great? You can take your car. Why would I want to bring my car on the beach? What are you, crazy? And so I think it's a fallacy, and it's held by a small group of people who are romanticizing about the past. It doesn't produce revenue. It doesn't help sell us.
I don't think it's going to be the last we'll hear of this beach driving issue, though. But we're going to move on. We're going to talk about something else after the break. You are listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. When we come back, we're going to talk about corruption and what it costs the taxpayer in Florida. Intersection returns in a minute.
Support for 90.7 News comes from the law firm of Pino Nicholson, dedicated to serving Central Florida in the areas of commercial law and securities, hosting a live interactive webinar for the business and investment community entitled How to Raise Capital, September 30th at 10 a.m. and October 1st at 6 p.m. Registration is at pinonicholsonlaw.com.
Good morning. I'm Nicole Creston. Nice to have you along on your Friday. You're listening to Intersection. Join the conversation. We're taking your calls live. You can also join us on Facebook or on Twitter at WMFE Orlando.
Support for 90.7 News comes from the Rollins Kremer Graduate School of Business, featuring Florida's first accredited executive DBA. Classes meet once per month. Learn more about obtaining your doctorate at a virtual information session on October 1st at 1 p.m. Register at rollins.edu/EDBA.
Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. In the studio with me, Daryl Owens from the Orlando Sentinel, Matt Reed, Florida Today, and joining us from Daytona Beach, Mark Bernier with WNDB. What's the cost of corruption? Well, Matt Reed writes in Florida Today that it costs taxpayers millions of dollars. That's to cover bid rigging, bribery, fraud, and waste. Now, Reed and Gannett newspapers want to pass an anti-corruption bill. Matt Reed, there's quite a lot to unpack here. Let's start with your bill. It wants to punish corruption with two simple fixes. What are they?
Well, these were ideas that were initially proposed by the statewide grand jury, which studied public corruption about 5 years ago, and nothing ever happened. They came up with a list of strong recommendations. What we did was, after writing about it for years and seeing no action taken on these, we decided it was time to act. So we went to prosecutors and said, of these recommendations, pick one or two that you think would make the biggest difference to make corruption more prosecutable, mm-hmm. make it easier for you to do your job. They gave us their feedback, and we reached out to a member of our editorial advisory board who is an attorney and has some lobbying experience. He drafted a model bill, and what it would do is this. It would subject contractors, government contractors, to the same public corruption laws as government employees. Right now, in a world of privatization, we are outsourcing entire divisions and functions of government to private contractors. And I think a lot of people would be surprised to know that if those people turn around and commit fraud and take kickbacks and bribes and that kind of thing, they are actually immune from prosecution under Florida's public corruption laws. They do not count and are not included in the definition of public servant. Mm-hmm. The other thing that we would do, and a lot of people don't know this about this, is we would remove a steep, unusual barrier to prosecuting public corruption. Right now in Florida, you have to prove not only that somebody did corrupt acts knowingly, as you would with any other crime, a prosecutor must prove that the defendant had corrupt thoughts. You have to come up with evidence that they knew in their mind that they were doing something corruptly and present it beyond a reasonable doubt. And so often, the FDLE, prosecutors and others will could be tipped off to something. They'll look at something and they will just say, we're not even going to pursue this because we know we don't have an admission. We don't have a wire. Mm-hmm. It's been done. Or this has been done by a contractor and we can't prosecute it. Mm-hmm. So we've got these two provisions. We came up with a model bill yesterday. We went out throughout the entire state in all of our markets with a front page call for sponsors for this bill. We tried to size up the problem in Florida. We've got a petition launched, and I think we are going to have a sponsor here before the end of the day.
1-866-338-5252. We're talking about corruption. We're talking about Matt Reed's anti-corruption bill, and he's looking for a sponsor for that bill. Corruption in Florida, how big of a problem is it? Can a anti-corruption bill find a sponsor? 1-866-338-5252. What have you seen which looks like corruption, which you think needs to be tackled by lawmakers, by law enforcement agencies as well? 1-866-338-5252. You can join the conversation. Matt Reed, you're kind of moving into the sphere of activism here. I'm wondering how that works with editorial independence.
Well, I'm the editorial page editor, and you know, we have a mission to engage people using all the different types of media that are at our disposal. And it is a little bit unusual, I'll give you that. But at some point, you know, as somebody whose job it is to advocate for the public good, sometimes writing a column or writing an editorial doesn't cut it. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you've got to get people mobilized. And if we are also to work in social media and we are to go out and do public in-person kinds of events and town hall meetings, then let's use those tools to get something really good done that's very concrete for the state. That's my take on it anyway, as somebody who's watched a heck of a lot of corruption stories unfold all over Central Florida, whether it was the Expressway Authority or mm-hmm. it's our clerk of court in Brevard County or it's somebody taking a bribe from developers in South Daytona, so on and so forth. It's time we did something.
Daryl Owens, what's a journalist and publisher's role in passing legislation? Where do you see the editorial line, the editorial wall on this?
Well, journalists aren't legislators, obviously, mm-hmm. but their newspapers have a long storied tradition of the editorial crusade. And what Matt has been describing here, and I, number one, want to stop for a minute and applaud Matt and his cohorts for doing this.
Thank you.
But what he's describing certainly fits into that cubbyhole. I think editorial boards, and as an editorial writer, I'm a member of the editorial board, we have a duty not only to nourish the community with information and with and to stir and engage the debate, but we also have an obligation, I think, to help to shape the community and mold it into a better place. And what Matt is proposing here, I think, goes a long way to doing that.
1-866-338-5252. What's your view on the role of newspapers, editorial staff, and trying to kind of push some of these fixes through to what seems to be a problem of corruption in Florida? 1-866-338-5252. Join the conversation. Mark Bernier, Matt Reed mentioned South Daytona Beach there. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the kind of response you would get to a bill like this from your listeners and perhaps lawmakers in your neck of the woods. What would people be saying about trying to get something done about corruption?
First, I want to join Daryl in complimenting Matt and his staff because they did their homework. Now, this is very much needed, and I think the public would support it. The story that Matt referred to in South Daytona was huge. It caught everybody by surprise. It almost made it look like government was asleep at the wheel while this was going on. And I think that it would be a wake-up call to anyone that's going to be from the private sector that's going to try to deal with government and services and providing and lending, that everything has to be in the sunshine. There are too many contracts that are still awarded without going through the full bidding process. I think the public would support this overwhelmingly. Mm-hmm. I know that I'm going to take this to my listeners because I think it's a great idea.
Well, you mentioned government and the sunshine there, and Daryl, I want to come back to you. One of the things Matt Reed talks about is the corruption scandal that rocked the Orlando Orange County Expressway Authority. You mentioned it just now. Led to a prison sentence for one of the board members, and part of the reason for reforming the Central Florida Expressway Authority, what is now that expanded authority with more members, more counties. But aren't Florida's government and the Sunshine Laws supposed to provide a counterweight to some of the allegations that tore up or led to the tearing up of the old Expressway Authority?
Well, Matthew, the short answer is yes, but sometimes even the best systems to protect the public break down as scofflaws find in runs around the safeguards.
Mm-hmm. And Matt Reed, the most egregious examples of corruption, was there a kind of a tipping point, something that, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of we need to get something more than just writing an editorial here?
Yeah, well, for us in Brevard County, it was when our clerk of courts was arrested and charged along with a contractor that he had essentially and allegedly rigged the bids with this company to steer them an $8 million deal to scan documents, a company called Blueware, mm-hmm. Three-quarters of which were eligible to be destroyed to begin with, but it was to digitize our records. There were other companies that could have done it for less money. A lot of it didn't have to be done at all, but this company agreed to pay kickbacks to his campaign fund, according to the FDLE, and he was in a really tough re-election race. He needed the cash, and he happened to have a friend, a longtime business and political associate, who was also representing this company. So he served as sort of a matchmaker. So all three were charged, but ultimately it is just the public official in this case who really faces the bulk of the charges.
Mm-hmm.
The private contractor is still in business. One of the key co-conspirators from the private contractor hasn't been charged at all and is now a witness. And what really scares me about this case is that had they gone undetected, here was a group of people who were willing to pay fast and loose with public money, and this company was about to take over the entire IT department of our court system. That company could have turned around and asked, you know, for bribes and could have wasted money and spent lavishly on themselves and taken trips to Asia and stuff, some other things that kind of were alleged in this whole activity, and would have been exempt from prosecution because it was privatized and they're not subject to the public corruption laws. That's scary.
I'm going to go to the phones now. We've got a call from Gary. Gary is calling from Orlando. Gary, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Would that bill prevent those quid pro quo deal that it appears, which in the Orlando area that I've heard occurring, such as a legislator or a public official would, for example, do something for a company, and 6 months later they'll leave the public post and go work for the company at three or four times what they were making?
So Gary, you're asking if Matt Reed's bill would do something to nip that in the bud?
Absolutely.
Well, Matt, what's the answer?
If it's something that we consider illegal today, this bill would just make it easier to prosecute that. This bill would not make any new activity newly illegal. It just makes it possible for prosecutors to go after the guilty,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Gary, thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So you are looking for a sponsor. You're pretty confident you're going to get one by the end of the day?
I think so. We got a call. My colleagues in Pensacola got a call from Senator Don Gates, the former Senate president, who's also known to be a pretty ethical guy. He said he expressed some interest in taking this up as part of a anti-corruption bill that he wants to introduce and in the Senate. I'm excited to call him back right after this show and to see what he has in mind. If he decides to take this on, he can count on the Gannett news sites to campaign in favor of this thing all the way through to passage.
We're going to leave that story, but it's an interesting issue. I'm sure we'll be able to come back to it down the track in future shows. Anti-corruption will follow how that bill goes. I want to talk a little bit about something that's been kind of overshadowing political news a little bit in the U.S. just in the last few minutes of the show here. Pope Francis has been visiting the country, as of course it's been pretty hard to avoid the news about that. The Pope addressed the U.S. Congress yesterday, hitting on some of his touchstone subjects, poverty, immigration. What does the papal view, though, add to the political conversation in this country? Darrell Owens, let me go to you with that question. You know, the Pope is a hugely popular figure globally. What kind of impact do you see his speech having on the political scene here? You know, there were quite a few presidential hopefuls in that congressional audience.
Well, Matthew, I think it will probably have the same impact that America's attempts at winning the hearts and minds of Middle Easterners who nurse an intractable hate for all things red, white, and blue.
Mm-hmm. And just a side note there, the Pope was introduced by Speaker of the House John Boehner. The New York Times is just reporting this morning, just in the last few minutes, that Speaker John Boehner, under intense pressure from conservatives in his party, this is according to Boehner's aides, according to the story in the New York Times, he is stepping down. He's going to give up his seat, House seat at the end of October. Daryl Owens, this is kind of a bolt from the blue.
Yeah, it's certainly shocking, and although I'm thinking that our local congressman, Dan Webster, is probably breathing a sigh of relief given that he is on Boehner's bad list, naughty list, for his failed coup earlier this year.
Mark Bernier, let me just go back to you with this question about the Pope. What effect do you see the Pope having, if any, on the presidential race here in the United States?
Probably little to none. There's the initial euphoria of being close to the pontiff. The Holy Father dealt with several issues. He threw red meat to both sides, if you'll pardon that expression, in terms of giving them something they wanted to hear. But I don't think they'll carry it very well. It was interesting. One of the network people said, I'm sure a lot of the people that were in this room are going to leave thinking, boy, do I have work to do. Well, that's going to last a day or two, because politics in this country is a blood sport. And I don't think that they will gravitate to the things that the Holy Father was pontificating when it comes right down to it and they have to get the vote of the people.
Matt Reed, in the last 30 seconds here, what's your take on the Pope's effect on politics in the United States?
I hope that it will. He's a big picture guy, and I hope that he helps sort of blow up our view a little bit and helps us focus on bigger bigger topics like environmental stewardship, compassion, helping our fellow man, that kind of stuff. Just as Donald Trump is blowing up the paradigm for a political presidential race, I hope that we can start thinking about some more important, bigger issues.
Matt Reed is a columnist with Florida Today, and he's also host of The Matt Reed Show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Bernier, host of The Mark Bernier Show with WNDB in Daytona Beach. Thanks for phoning in, Mark.
That was so much fun. Thanks so much, guys.
And Daryl Owens, columnist and editorial staffer at the Orlando Sentinel. Thank you so much, Daryl.
Always a pleasure, Matthew.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Executive producer is Catherine Welch. You can join us again Tuesday morning at 9 on 90.7 News. We'll be talking about human trafficking in Central Florida. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.